And we're back. Matthew got super small. Oh, there he is. Mini me.
Hi, everybody.
This is the Durin Show, episode number 20. I am joined by two people. I don't care how they're doing, so we're just going to go right into our agenda. It's been a while, guys. How you can judge me all you want, but how are things?
Things are going good.
They're much better. Given this modified intro, I like it.
Very good. Very good.
We're spicing things up.
We were hard on him last time, and he's
why is it spicy?
And we have some random like Council of the Elders on top of Mount Everest going on. I like this. We were chatting before we hit live. We haven't been playing a ton of games since our last episode, but we got two. Well, Mitchell's been playing a lot of games. So in the Seattle area, I think we've had two game days where like the monthly, everybody comes out and plays games all day Saturday. That's coming back. We've got two of those in. They've been a ton of fun. Mitchell's been doing that plus a bunch of other stuff. And Matt's basically sworn off this game, said he'd never play it again. And then he came out and played Mitchell. So I don't know what's happening.
Yep.
Yep. What do we have on the agenda? We have a couple rules that have come up. So we all took way too long of a break, and so the first game back, it's like, man, I can't remember any rules, and a couple of these are really unique, I think. So we'll go through those. We touched on the idea of critiquing models back when the dwarf lords or the old Dane was it
and
old Dane
acolytes?
I think
yeah old Dan and young Thorin, I guess Thorin Stoneheim and the acolytes when they all came out.
Yeah, because people were just dogging on the models a ton. And we had like a little spiel about playtest stuff before you really write it off. And holy cow, definitely want to touch on this, adding those. Plus, my Lurtz's Legendary Legion. I really want to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And then we got some upcoming tournaments that we're going to touch on. So,
yep.
Yeah, it'll be interesting.
Yep, it's been great to get finally in the swing of things. Monthly game days are back, I feel like. That's been awesome just to get a group setting, because we started that in the Seattle area at least, and it's been great. We usually had like 8 to 10 people show up regularly every month, and we finally got that going again. It feels really good.
Pat came up from Portland for one weekend. That was
Pat,
fun.
Pat drove up. We had a good showing there. We're scheduling tournaments again. I got ones in the works for September that I'm coordinating with a couple of the Seattle guys. That'll be fun. And then I'm trying to get another one hopefully by the end of the year, because I'm starved for tournaments in the area, so I'm trying to get things rolling there.
I was gonna say I had an epic tournament that I was gonna go to in August. I think it was
what was it called?
Articon, something like that, but then somebody bailed.
Not my fault.
Anyways.
Well, we do have a replacement for it at least, because someone I forget who it was, has now entered Middle Earth Strategy Battle Game into the Las Vegas Open. So we have an open on the West Coast, which we are hopefully all of us are
Las
going.
Vegas isn't the West Coast. Close though.
Okay. But it's on the right side of the United States. I'll take what I can get, okay?
But that's 2022, isn't it? So that's a ways out.
January.
But I think it's January, so it's right after New Year's.
I'm definitely going to that.
Yeah, it'll be a blast. Yeah. I already bought Mitchell and I are we bought tickets and we're doing the doubles. Yep. Because he was the first person to ask me and I couldn't say no. I love it. Actually let's switch up the order. So what tournaments we have upcoming? Mitchell, you got the one that you're planning for the Seattle area. It's late September, right?
Like September 18th. I don't have my calendar anymore, but September 18th, I think it's a Saturday. It's going to be a one day, just a little local one to get everybody back in the swing of things. And I think the weekend after that, the Canadians are doing one. And that's kind of a cool one because he's done teams. So you have a good side and an evil side. And you split them up into teams.
I think we both joined Team Evil.
Yes, we did. If the border is opened up by then and everything like that, there's a lot of what-ifs still.
It opened up, I think, this week. I think it's open.
I think they pushed out till the 21st, but we can look into it. So we'll see. But that's looking promising at least, and that'll be a ton of fun. And then I know the North Carolina guys messaged us about their upcoming events, mm-hmm. and you'll have to bear with me because I need to look up the exact names. But I believe North Carolina. Do you remember the names off your top of your head?
No, I accidentally closed the page, so I'm trying to get back to their Facebook.
Here, I got it right here. All right, okay. So in October, Misty Mountains Mayhem.
Oh, this is the repeat. This is the repeat that they did last year.
Yes, it is.
The one
we went to. It was a blast. So this is the one that's held by Chad. Last year it was a escalation one. I think this one's just a straight 800 points. It's 5 rounds.
Yeah.
And Chad is the one that's hosting that one. That was a great, great event, I think.
That was super fun.
Yeah, yeah. And then I know Jason is doing an event next year. He's also a North Carolina guy. And I can't remember. I think it's still in planning about what day, but it's going to be an open event. So you're talking a major event also. That's probably, I think he was saying next June, which is going to be pretty cool out there. So that's a good shout out to do as well.
This is going to be one of the qualifying events. So like if you place well on that, you get entered into the international stuff in the UK.
No, I don't think this
one is. It's one of the Masters qualifiers.
It is. It is. Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Ooh, wow. That'd be really fun.
Because we only have, I think we only had two, right? Because it was only Nova and Articon before. So now we'll have three finally.
Three. Yes.
That'd be awesome.
And then just a couple other quick shout outs. You've got the Two Towers TriStar tournament that Austin Featherstone and John Billy are putting on. That's August 20th through the 22nd. That'll be a fairly big one. And then
Where is that one? Is that in Nashville or is that in?
Yes. No, that's okay. The Nashville one. And then we've got the big Texas one that Charles Torok puts on. Millennium Con, if I can even say that, Millennium Con. And so that'll be one for me where I don't have to travel too far. That's the 11th through the 14th of November.
Cool. We'll have to come down and have a little like pre-Thanksgiving celebration.
Yeah, Round Rock, Texas. So that'll be fun. That's a fairly decent, because that's a gaming convention and it's Middle Earth is one of the events going on.
Ooh, that'd be fun.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
And I heard might be a few of the DC Hobbit League coming to the Millennium Con one.
Ooh. Oh, really? That'd be.
Yeah, they posted some interest.
Okay. Because I think I've only played with the North Carolina crew and the Nashville crew for the last year, it feels like.
So. Yeah, I've never played the DC guys. I just the North Carolina guys.
Yeah, it's been since Nova since I've got to play them, and besides just casual games with a couple of them that travel down here every once in a while.
It'll be a blast.
Cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Lots to look forward to. So that's coming up. We'll keep doing updates if things change or if we screwed something up on the details. But
that's the main reason why our episodes have also slowed down is because games are finally back in swing. It seems like we're getting busy. Things are opening up. Not just for hobby wise, but vacation wise and stuff like that. So,
yeah, without a doubt.
It's really about reliving game experiences, talking about strategy. So, when we run dry on recent experiences or tournaments, it feels like we're going to consciously make a decision to have less episodes versus switching over to theoretics and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've talked about this 100 times, but without a doubt, my favorite part is like building random lists, getting ready for an event when you know what the point limit is, trying to craft that ultimate winning combination, and then telling everybody why it didn't work. So,
oh yeah, that's what I've been doing nonstop for the last couple of weeks. Because once I found out the Las Vegas Open was going to happen, that's a good and evil. So I've been building two lists that I've been trying to theory craft, play test, and put up against as much as I can to see what will happen. But it's been fun.
Which begs the question, without giving away your lists, if you had to say to play for the ability to keep playing Middle Earth, and you had one good army and one evil army, at 800 points, what's your good and what's your evil?
Probably the ones I've been most comfortable with, honestly, and played a lot recently. I don't think I dig out. I would have said, if you asked me 2 years ago, I probably would have said Khazad Doom, but I haven't played Khazad Doom in 2 years, so I don't think I'm as comfortable with them now.
So I think you're Khand and Lothlorien?
I wouldn't actually go with Lothlorien. I would go with Fields of Celebrant. I'm going Earl and his sons.
That's a strong.
Yeah.
I think I would probably do Kingdom of Moria for good and Angmar for bad, for evil.
Those are also really strong. Those are really strong.
I like it. Yeah, I do Corsairs Harad for evil, and then I would do Army of Thror for good.
Yeah. I've been playtesting an Easterling Khand alliance, and I've been bashing on that alliance pretty hard because I've always wanted either pure Khand or pure Easterlings, but I think I'm stumbling on a balance that I kind of like, but I haven't playtested it that much, so we'll see. We'll see. Needs more stress testing.
Very good. All right, well, let's jump into these rules questions that we've cataloged to go through. I just have this in the order that we were chatting about it in our little group thread here. So, number one, this is a what if, can you do it type question. So, in the situation where you lose a combat and you're trying to back away, so you're trying to retreat that 1 inch, and you can't retreat a full inch. So, let's say you have like 0.7 inches or whatever of room. The question is, can you back away that 0.7 inches and still be trapped? Because the rules are clear. If you can't back away a full inch, you're trapped. But can you back away that 0.7 inches and still be trapped? Or are you stuck without moving, without being able to back away and also be trapped? So let me say that a different way.
Yeah.
Can you make way? No, not make way. Can you back away 1 inch or less than 1 inch, or does it have to be 1 inch or nothing?
That's a great way. And I'll give the example why this rules question came up. I was playing, I was playing Richard online, and he had the Watcher, and I had two models engaged, and we were kind of pulled into this tight terrain piece. And so both of them would be trapped. But if I moved one model 0.9 inches or whatever it wasn't quite a full inch, it would give my second model room to back away 1 inch to where it replaced where he was.
So only one would be trapped.
Only one would be trapped. And he goes, well, is it all or nothing? Like you said, can you back away full 0.9 inches, take the trap, take the double strikes, or can you not move at all?
So we talked like a few episodes ago about what does backing away when you lose the duel represent? And we all decided it's supposed to represent you stumble backwards and you're trying to regain your footing. And trapped is when you stumble backwards and you don't have enough room. Yeah. So I think you'd still go back as far as you can because you can't help the fact that you're stumbling and you don't have enough room to recover. So you're trapped, but you still back the 0.9.
I would like to read three paragraphs, if that's okay with you guys, really quick. I'll try.
You don't believe in reading rules?
I know.
We believe in just saying what we feel emotionally.
I know. This is what I think.
Is this FAQs or is this page 44?
This is page 44. So this is
the rules of the main rule book.
Of the main rule book. So with the duel's winners determined, the loser must back. Okay, I'll re-say that. The loser must back away in the direction chosen by the controlling player. To back away, the loser must move 1 inch in a straight line away from the winner. Although this does not have to be directly away. When a loser backs away, it can move through enemy control zone, but cannot move into base contact with an enemy model. Backing away is not slowed by difficult terrain. Backing away cannot be used to cross obstacles or to take jump leap or climb tests. However, a loser at the edge, and this talks about the edge stuff, and then right next to it is trapped. And this is in the swirl of close combat, it's quite common for a model to be unable to make a full back away move. This puts them in a position of extreme danger. If a model cannot back away a full 1 inch when they lose the fight, they are trapped. Usually this occurs when a model is backed against terrain, such as a wall or boulder, or is completely surrounded by enemy models. It is important for surviving models to be separated once a fight has been resolved. So be sure the loser backs away enough to separate the bases of the models if you can. If the losing model is unable to back away at all because it is pinned in place by multiple attacks or by an obstacle, then it does not move and the models are left in base contact until after the winners have resolved their strikes, after which they separate themselves by just enough that you can see a little space between them.
Aha, I am justified. So I think the key there is it says if it can't back away at all, then they remain in place. So that's saying if it can back away a little bit, it still does.
Wait, sorry, were you, Mitchell, I like zoned out there. Were you reading from the striking you trapped model section?
It's trapped on 45.
So skip to 46, the last paragraph of striking a trap model. The last paragraph says, if a trap model is unable to back away and survives the strikes, then the attacker must back away just enough to separate the models.
Right. And that's what it says under trap too as well. It says it's important for surviving models to be separated once the fight has been resolved. So be sure to back away the loser enough to separate the bases of the models if you can.
So in my mind, because of those two paragraphs, it's an all or nothing. If you can, and this is the way I've actually played it.
No way.
If you can't back away 1 inch, then you're trapped. You're stuck in place. You take your strikes, and then the winner backs away a millimeter if they can't kill you.
So this is, I think this is a great debate because I actually didn't know the answer. This is up to interpretation because it does say you separate.
Hey, can we pause really quick though? How the heck did this get an FAQ that literally restates the rules verbatim? Because in the making away or in the backing away part, it says difficult terrain does not impede your 1 inch. We also have an FAQ that says the exact same thing.
Yeah, that happens quite a lot.
Like that's how? Why isn't the FAQ see page 44 or whatever it is?
Yeah. I think it's just must have been asked enough for them to be like, okay, fine, we'll say it again, you know. I think going back to the rules question, I think the key there is that it says loser backs away enough to separate the bases if you're trapped.
No, the winner.
No, I'm talking about the loser.
Winner doesn't back away. It says the winner backs away if the loser's unable to back away at all. The winner only backs away enough to separate.
That is
so correct. Page 46, the last paragraph of Striking a Trapped Model makes it clear. It says if a trapped model was unable to back away and survives the strike made against it, then the attacker must back away just enough to separate the model instead. So that shows that the loser backs away a full inch if preferable, a half inch if that's all he's got, and then the combat's resolved. If there's no room to back away, you resolve the combat, and then the winner backs away just enough to separate them. I think it's pretty plain.
I agree with you, and I want to agree with you. The only thing and I'm not saying you're wrong. I want to throw this out there. This wording right here is what I'm hung up on, which is it is important for any surviving models to be separated once the fight has been resolved. So be sure to back away the loser enough to separate the bases of the models. Wait, if you can.
Where is that part?
That is under trapped on page 45. Under trapped, it's the third paragraph.
Oh, yeah, I see this. Okay.
So it's just saying back away the loser enough to separate the bases. So what's enough? Is it the 0.9 so that you can back away? Or is it just enough to get a gap? That's where the rules...
Wait, doesn't this contradict it? So in 45, it says the loser backs away, but then in...
That's only if the loser cannot back away at all. If there's if you've completely trapped him with three models, the loser cannot move at all to separate the bases. So the winners would separate the bases. That's what it's saying.
That's why in capture and control, you've got one guy sitting on the objective, you never want to completely trap them, because if you don't kill them, you back away and they stay on the objective and you don't claim it. So if you completely surround them and trap them, you want to make sure that you're going to get a kill. Otherwise, you want it in a point where they back away and they lose control.
Okay, I changed my mind based on page 45 wording. I think I glossed over that too quickly because it does say in order of operations before any strikes are made, you have to back away the loser if you can. And so if you're backing away the loser, I don't think there's any delineation between 0.01 and 0.09 inches. So I changed my mind.
You're still accepting the trap, but you're still separating the bases, thus following the rules.
Yeah, I think as much we're as on you can. Page there.
So,
I agree.
So that
and the premise is you can't choose to stumble. You don't get to choose. You lose a duel, you stumble.
Right.
Right. That's what this whole thing represents.
Yes.
Well, but this gives the loser some shenanigans because you can back up 0.01 or 0.09. Because this is huge when you're talking about people who are kiting a big monster or a big hero, because you're going to lose the fight. You don't, a lot of times you'll intentionally trap your model just to make sure that the attacking hero doesn't have more space to go and do the hero combat or the barge or whatever it is. So you can choose to back up 0.01 inches. You don't have to back up 0.09 inches. So you have, I would say this gives you flexibility within the range. You'll still be trapped.
But yes,
a lot of times I don't want to give space.
And I want to clarify this right off the bat for people who are listening. You must back away a full inch if you can. You cannot choose to be trapped. You cannot choose to only back away 0.1 except the trap. This is if you are unable to back away a full inch. That's the only circumstance this is coming into the play.
Correct. Yeah, 100%. Not to be confused with making way with a supporting model.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a sensitive topic, as you can tell.
It's a very sensitive topic for us.
There is no negotiation for backing away.
You must back away full inch. It's just if you cannot back away a full inch, are you allowed to choose how far you back away? That's the only thing.
And we agree, yes. As much as you can, or just enough to separate a model.
I would agree there.
All right.
Okay. All right. Well, definitely be interested to see comments, see if everybody agrees with us.
Leave a comment.
We said page numbers too, and I don't think we missed any of the FAQs, because I think the only FAQs on this are related to the optional making way, which is not the same thing as backing away.
Yep.
And if backing away is impeded by difficult terrain. Okay, number two. And this one's frustrating, but we'll go through this. And the question is, if the Watcher or the Balrog pulls a war beast or chariot, does the Watcher or Balrog take impact hits or impact damage in these use cases? So this would be the Balrog pulls a chariot. So the chariot, when it moves, typically it does the two impact hits. The Mumak, when it moves, it activates trample. So the question here is not if a... Well, actually, I want to split this into two. Can the Watcher or the Balrog pull a war beast with this lash? And then the second part of the question is, does the Watcher or Balrog take subsequent impact hits from these things getting pulled into base contact?
So we've already debated this and we've already kind of talked about this. So I think it would be great if we just roll out what we found, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
Okay. So number one, under War Beast, it says they are not to be moved. They are unmovable, right? Against their will, only by commanding the driver.
List a page number for this one, because I didn't see the page number initially.
Page 80.
I didn't see this.
So page 80 is the War Beast. I'm losing where it says it specifically, but I do have a screenshot of an FAQ that says, so here's FAQ for this. How does Instill Fear magical power affect models that cannot be moved against their will, such as Smog, such as War Beasts or Chariots? So models that cannot be moved against their will, or models with unusual movements, are considered to automatically pass their courage test. So in that FAQ, it says that war beasts are immune
from this lash and pull.
Right. They cannot
Watcher
be moved against
or
their
Balrog.
Will. Right. Yeah. So that leaves chariots, though. Chariots are open. Okay.
So you listed chariots in that models that cannot be moved, as chariots.
That was specifically for Instill Fear. Sorry. I'm pulling from an FAQ specifically for Instill Fear. Sorry.
Okay.
So, but a chariot can be dragged. That's a cavalry model.
Yep.
It's just pulled. So the debate was, when you pull a chariot, because this happened to me, you pull the chariot into base contact with the Watcher. The wording for the chariot is specifically.
Well, list the special rule for the movement on the chariot.
This is the chariot charge on page 189 of the Armies of the Lord of the Rings rulebook under the chariots. This is, once the chariot has pivoted to face its desired direction, move it forwards in the desired amount in a straight line, ignoring enemy model's control zones. Any model that the chariot comes into contact with whilst moving, not pivoting, will suffer 2 strength 4 hits. So there's the big date. So you're moving my chariot. It comes into contact with the Watcher. Does it do 2 strength 4 hits? this is what I found. And this is the very, very specific wording under both the Balrog's lash and under the Watcher. It's both. They do not say they move the chariot. It says they drag. Yeah. And that's very,
and this
very...
is this is the this is the keyword. It's keyword move, not like literally they're moving. Like yes. moving for backing yes. away. Your base is moving. That is not keyword moving.
Absolutely, 100%.
And it actually says in the FAQ, backing away doesn't count as moving.
Correct, 100%. And I just wanted to clarify that for everybody. So it's being dragged towards them into base contact, even over intervening models or terrain. So the idea is they're picking up, they're bringing it over, they're pulling it in. Yeah. It's
Think
not
about
actually
Boromir getting like right. shaken yep. up in the air type deal.
It's not actually moving, which I think is key. So the chariot has to be moving, which is why when you command or compel a chariot, you are moving them. They are doing the moving action, which is why then they would deal the strength 4 impact hits, or the if you're doing the Iron Hills chariot, same thing. Yeah. But this is why I don't believe they would impact hit the Balrog or the Watcher, because you are dragging them, you are not moving them. And that's what I found.
And this is consistent with kind of how we ruled. I think we talked about like 4 or 5 episodes ago, we talked about this exact same use case, but a mounted model with a lance. Does the mounted model with the lance get the charge bonus if they get drug into the Balrog or the Watcher? And with the exact same logic, we said they're not moving, that therefore they can't get the charge, therefore they don't get the charge bonus of the lance. So we're being consistent.
Yeah, I think that's with the Watcher, not necessarily with the Balrog.
The Balrog too. So if the Balrog lashes a like Knight of Dol Amroth into base contact, the Knight of, and we said if the Knight of Dol Amroth, we said both. If the Knight of Dol Amroth didn't charge or didn't move, so they were second in the priority and the Balrog lashed them, yeah. they wouldn't get the charge bonus of moving. And yeah, we also said in that use case, if the Knight of Dol Amroth had moved first, charged a goblin, and then the Balrog came in and lashed it, we said that canceled the charge. They didn't count as charging anymore because they got displaced.
So okay. Under the Watcher... it says models moved under this way do not count as having charged. That's very clear to me. Cancels lances, cancels any cavalry bonus charge, all that stuff. Monsters yep. charge. Yep. Yeah. And it under the Balrog, it does not say that.
Yeah, but I would still stick with our logic of the lash. If you're 12 inches away, or whatever, I can't remember, 8 inches, whatever the range is on that lash. I can't remember.
8 inches.
If you get pulled,
right,
it doesn't make sense for you to be charging one way and get pulled 180 degrees the opposite way. You don't have momentum. You're not right. on your horse. Like I think essence of the game, it does not make sense to keep the cavalry bonus.
So you're applying the common sense rule in this case.
Yes.
Matt, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I just think it's a hole in the rules writing. If you're mounted, you should not suffer the knocked flying. Because really, there's no way for them to lash a horse and for you to stay yeah. on it. I mean, the whole thing is kind of silly.
Yes, yeah. it is. But I just found it interesting that the Watcher specifically says, in its tentacles rule, models moved in this way do not count as having charged.
Well,
it's not.
I feel like that's in there because the Watcher can shoot at people in combat with itself.
Yes.
So I can, if a bunch of horses charge me, I can get lucky, roll a 6, have 6 shots, and then hit all 6 horses that charge me, and I cancel all of their charges. So okay. that's for the thing where like somebody charges into base contact with you, but you're still shooting. I think that's why the rule, I think that's the clarification there, because that's okay. a huge tactical advantage for the Watcher.
It is.
Who otherwise is most of the time.
By the way,
disadvantage.
Side note, the Watcher is a really annoying model to deal with.
Oh yeah, especially if they are good with their goblin screens and
yes.
the goblin screens up. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what they're doing. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, we're ready to move on from that one, I think.
Okay, number 3. What happens if a model is charged? Then in the movement phase, the model that initiated the charge is killed by an impact hit. Can the model that was originally charged move as normal? So like this, I think you guys were playing a Far East, so that it was the camels.
Farhad.
So I'm assuming what this is an Easterling charges in, so a cataphract charges in
yep.
to a little camel guy, and yep. then another camel joins the combat, kills the cataphract with the impact hit.
Okay.
And so that camel who got the impact hit kill, he can keep moving as long as the move is left. Go impact hit somebody else. Can the originally charged camel go through its move phase and impact hits as normal?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And after I panicked a little bit today, because I was like, oh, this one's easy. I know right where this is. And I couldn't find it. And I read, and I must have skimmed over it. You know when you're looking for something, you can't find it? That's exactly what happened. Finally, thank you, Charles, pointed it out to me. I found it. It's on page 24 of the rules manual. Yep. And it says, there is an occasion when models that are already engaged in combat might suddenly find itself unengaged. A model that has charged an enemy may have been slain by a throwing weapon or magical power, causing their opponent to become disengaged. Yep. If this happens, the newly disengaged model's opportunity to move then the newly disengaged model's opportunity to move has not yet passed. It may still do so.
Yep.
So,
boom. That's an easy one.
Yep.
Yeah.
Easy.
It is easy, but it's really impactful to your strategy if you know that that's the way that works.
Yes. So camels peeling off a Moomak. Now, if you see that strategy, that's exactly what that strategy is for.
Yes.
That's
one person charging into the Moomak.
You start peeling your camels off of your Moomak. Now your Moomak gets its trample damage.
Yes.
That's huge. It's also, it makes throwing weapons on evil armies like the Corsairs that much more scary because you can put in a warband of throwing weapons. Who has throwing weapons that are evil?
Acolytes.
It makes acolytes because acolytes actually, that's a better option because they're cheap and they can ally in with all of these weird cavalry, Harad, Far East,
Mordor.
Who is the war beast the royal Moomak under?
Oh, that's Far Harad.
Not Far East.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and it's also like prowlers for the Belrog, so he's not having to use his
That's
a great shout.
Combat.
Too.
Yeah.
That actually I think is a better because the prowlers are what, 7 points? If you just have an army of prowlers, they're gonna have to invest a lot of resource. And it's hard because terrifying ancient evil. It's hard to get that charge to begin with. So that's an even better strategy.
Nice.
Okay, our last rule. I think this wasn't easy too. So this was, it's specifically about line of sight. How do you determine line of sight? Because we had some like legacy house rules kind of impacting our judgment here. So
thanks models. A lot.
Yeah. Models that are like weirdly positioned. So specifically the dragon. If you think about the dragon's base, it's elongated. The dragon's kind of like stretched out over the entire base, and then its head is off on the side, actually off the base, looking off in the distance. So how do you draw a line of sight from the dragon? So it's got the fire breath. How do you determine who the dragon can see to target for the fire breath? And what we all said, it's house rules, we used to make Mitchell like literally get at the eye level, and the dragon could only shoot at who the eyeballs on the dragon could see because we hated the dragon. But actual rules, I think we all agree, is it's a dynamic model. The rules clearly say the models are positioned, but you should treat them as dynamic. But for the purposes of line of sight, correct me if I'm wrong, we said keep the dragon's head. That's where you would still do line of sight, but you have a 360 degree swivel from the head. So you have the elevation of the head, but 360-degree view to shoot from.
Yeah, and apologies to Richard. Again, this came up with the Watcher. That's why I was like, well, the Watcher can't really see anything. And then he was showing me some rules, and it was just going against what I was thinking in my head, and then I had to cave, and I gave in. And I said, yep, you're right.
Lame.
So, but there was another rules clarification that came out of this. So an oval base, another reason why this is huge, actually, I think. An oval base is very, very weird because in the rules manual, it states pretty clearly that models can spin as much as they want because most bases are round.
Spin right? to get charged. Like you don't have to use movement to move. Like if I'm an Aragorn, I can do a 180 and charge 6 inches.
Exactly.
I don't have to count that as part of my move.
And there's very specific models that say if it contradicts this rule, right? So like a war beast must pivot and then move. Like it says very specifically, but it's allowed to pivot any direction.
And it even stipulates like, and if it can't move, just move models the shortest distance out of the way to let the pivot happen.
Exactly. And then chariots are another thing that comes to mind where there's a very specific, it can only pivot 45 degrees and then move in a straight line. So it's very clear about when things must move in a straight line and when they're allowed to spin freely. So things like the Watcher, the Dragon, Balg, all these things, and I think this has come up with Balg before, where you're allowed to spin it to gain an advantage. Radagast Slay is another one I can think of it. And I was thinking, does this spin cost movement? Technically, by the rules, as far as what I've seen and dug through the rules, rotating your oval base does not cost you any movement, which I think is pivoting. Really, yeah, pivoting. Yes, rotating
I hear you, Mitchell, and I know we talked about this, but I changed my mind because of the Cave Drakes. Cave Drakes have the same oval base, and it actually, it's huge with the Cave Drakes because that's one of their biggest downfalls is the fact that they're just too big to get a lot of places, and it's easy to kite them.
Yep.
I think I would agree it doesn't cost you movement to pivot your base, but you can't pivot your base into control zones. So you're not going to force people to move. You're not going to displace people by pivoting your base. So I think if you are in open terrain, pivot your base and move, fine. Get the little extra advantage, whatever. If you are in combat or if you're in the thick of the fray, you can't pivot your base, force other enemy models to be displaced to allow you to pivot and then move. You're stuck.
That is absolutely clear. I agree with that because that specifically says that in War Beast, when you pivot, you displace models. But what this does allow is something like a dragon who has the fly ability can now fly in midair, rotate his base, right, and land things further than what he used to be able to based on his previous position. Or things like a Cave Drake who has a little sliver of a lane that he can slide out of, then rotate his base sideways and charge a battle line. Because that sliding sideways doesn't cost anything. So just some interesting tactics. I know people have been doing this with Balg all the time. We just haven't played Balg a lot. And this is kind of mind-blowing for us for bigger monsters.
Yeah, oval bases are unique for sure.
Yep.
Okay, so I think that's all of our rules questions. Let's get into the thick of it. And the first topic, hold on, let me get back to my notes here. Mitchell, you replied too many times. I lost it. Here we go. main topic for tonight. Okay, this is what we touched on in our last episode. Judging models before you get a chance to actually play test them. Specifically, the new dwarf models, the acolytes, and I want to include Army of Lurts. So, Mitchell, why don't you kick us off on this one?
Well, I'm not an expert or anything. I just always want to give things the benefit of the doubt. So like new models that come out or armies that are criticized, those are actually like an attraction to me because it's not very common. People are usually bashing on it or this idea. And I'm like, well, I can try to make it work. And then I love trying to figure out how to make something work. So that's where I founded my Earl the Young list, right? You never see Earl the Young. And they said you can't do Earl the Young beyond 500 points. And then I started playing Earl the Young beyond 500 points. And guess what? It works better. And everybody I played with this army says that works way better than I ever thought. I was like, well, this is why you got to test things. Because
as they're walking away from a 12-0 loss.
Yes. And I was like, this is why you got to test things. Things don't always show themselves on paper. They do much, much different things on the battlefield. I think everybody can agree with that. So I just have a little bit of a gripe with like the acolytes. Because they weren't strength 4, everybody wrote them off. And I'm like, well, you don't know what it does to the army. I play Easterlings all the time. It completely changed the army. And I know they're not game-breaking, but they're better than people are giving them credit for. I 100% stand behind that.
It opens up your army to just so many more tactics. Like we talked about this again. Like Easterlings used to be, you either are super mounted heavy, you run a monster, and then you have your shield wall and just hope you kill things faster than the shield wall dies. Now, you have other options. You can still do that exact same strategy, but
now you have the throwing weapons. You have something to engage in Aragorn. You don't have to throw your Amder into Aragorn and
you
say,
can be a,
hopefully. Yeah, you can
throw
an
Acolyte. You have a skirmisher army. You have a skirmisher army.
Absolutely. You can throw something light, throw some daggers in it, kill your own guy. That strategy opens up. We just talked about this earlier about killing your own models to free up your main model. So now your Amders or your Dragonites can't be pinned or something like that. I mean, just it does change things. And I, that's why I like the new dwarves. I'm absolutely not going to say they're terrible. I have never played with them. I don't play Iron Hills. I don't play Erebor Reclaimed or anything like that. But I'm not going to say they're terrible until I see them on the battlefield. Maybe if I beat them four or five times, I might start having my opinions on them. But I'm not going to write them off right the bat. And I just, it just kind of baffles me sometimes that people are so, and not saying that everybody does this. I'm not trying to gripe on everybody. It's just
the like, Facebook pages are always like inundated with these.
Yeah. And I'm like, just try it. See what happens. Like, just try it. Maybe it is terrible. Maybe it isn't. Maybe, I don't know.
This is like, this is my pet peeve. This is for those out there thinking about black darts. Like when the whole thing about the horses can't resist and everybody's going off about how black darts are so OP. And it's like, man, have you guys actually played against ring rates with black darts? Do you understand the rate at which that three up to wound something fails?
Yes.
Do you understand? Not only that, do you understand the rate at which people roll a one to wound on the black dart? I feel like that's like 50% just in my games.
And you had a great point too on this. Even if they do get the successful black dart, they one punch your 10-point horse, right? They kill it right off the bat. How many resources do they have to minimally invest in just to get that go off? You're talking at least 2 to 3 will. I don't know any ring rate that's going to one dice it unless you're talking the black red legendary.
There's not enough turns in a game to justify throwing one will at a 5+ spell.
Exactly.
So in my opinion.
So you're talking 3 will, right?
Unless you're the Witch King with the crown, you'll see it sometimes.
Okay, that's a good shout. A reroll. Okay. That's a good point.
And the Necromancer.
Yeah, Necromancer. That's a good point.
Well, he doesn't have Black Dart.
He's got Chill Soul.
He's got even better. Same thing.
Yeah.
Same
actually, thing. He that's no.
That no, is, Chill Soul's better because all you got to do is cast it.
That is OP. I'll take that one off the board. He is. The Necromancer's amazing.
And Sauron. Sauron, throw Sauron in there too. But
that Necromancer would be amazing if his spells were 18-inch range or he cost 20 point less. He sucks as is. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
It's but anyway, so hard to play against him, though. I understand he's got so many limited factors, but if you're on the other end, I was watching – sorry, this is a tangent. I was watching a game just recently where one of the guys was playing the Necromancer, and it was Assassination. And the guy that was playing against the Necromancer had – probably 4 or 5 possible targets. Like it was one of the worst matchups, but the whole game, the Necromancer was like, Chill Soul. Did I kill that one right? I don't know, but let me go on to the next one. The Necromancer is just assassinating all of these heroes with his Chill Soul. And it was a genius, like great, great strategy. And the other guy didn't have a chance. See that, it's disheartening. You're like, I can't kill the Necromancer fast enough.
Yes. Yep, that is true. But no. I just think you admit it, the black dart thing, you're investing at least, let's say, 10 to 15 points minimum.
Well, you're investing with a risk. You're investing 5, 10, 15 points, however many will you spend, and you're not guaranteed it's going to work. You're not guaranteed, number one, you're going to cast the spell, because I failed a ton of 3 will black darts. It happens. Everybody's flopped a roll with, we talked about this, 3 dice attack heroes. You're not guaranteed to roll 6. You're not guaranteed to roll 5. And you have to still wound them with 1 dice.
Mm. Yep.
You fail a lot. Just and try you always it. Fail. You always fail in the most inconvenient times.
I think part of the armies that I decide to play, so like the Easterlings, the Khan, the Earl of the Young, Field of Calamrance, or any other army I choose to play, I think part of the reason why I enjoy it so much is just to have my opponent underestimate it. And I think that's really, really fun. Just to walk in, them automatically, you can kind of see it. They're like, okay, all you have is Earl the Young. You have one named hero. Okay, cool. Yeah. At 1,000 points or whatever. And it's just fun, I think.
Yeah. Okay, other armies that are written off. So I'm including Lurch's Legendary Legion, Lurch's Scouts Legendary Legion. And the thing, so I had been talking about this for a long time, putting the army together, finally getting to play it. I was going through YouTube trying to find bat reports with this Legendary Legion. I found a couple Ugluk Scouts Legendary Legion. There's nothing with Lurts. Nobody is playing it. And everybody I talk to assumes that the Lurts' Legendary Legion is going to play worse than Ugluk's because you don't have the +1, the animosity rule, the +1 wounding. Okay, so that was the premise. again, Mitchell, to your point, people writing this off. I've finally played the Legendary Legion. I've played three games, and it is unreal. Yes, they have significant drawbacks, but there are a couple unbelievable disadvantages you can throw at your opponent. So let me just be specific. I played, what was the army? Last Alliance, which you think is a horrible matchup, but terrain didn't allow the total bubble, the Kirdan bubble to, or it wasn't Kirdan actually. It was a Last Alliance without Kirdan. So that could have been different. But even with the terrain, they didn't have the ability to do the full bubble. They were slightly split in their battle lines. Swarm them, one turn. Like I move so fast. I'm up in
no
the battle
shooting.
Line.
No shooting. You don't have the gap with your animosity where your orcs are left way behind and you're like, oh, I'm getting shot to pieces, but I got to get my Uruks in there and wait for the orcs to catch up so I can get this animosity rule.
Turn two, I had on one flank, I had the entire flank, the entire elven battle line front and back. Like I was tagging people front and back. And so if I had priority, there was going to be a ton of traps because like they were completely surrounded. That was a very close game. I think I ended up losing that one at the very end just because Elendil did his thing and I couldn't. I played bad with my heroes and my resources. But still, toe-to-toe up until the very end against Last Alliance, which I think is a significant disadvantage for this army. I played Army of the Dead, the Legendary Legion. What's that? Return of the King?
Yep.
This is the one I laugh about. So not only did I get an amazing scenario, I got Seize the Prize. First turn. So it's 12 inches away. First turn, I marched and drummed. I am 4 inches past the objective. And there's actually no way my opponent can counter that. So I'm past the objective. I dig it up, and it's going to be a football sprint. I'm going to march and drum again, and my dude's going to move 14 inches left to right. With that army, there's no way they could block it because they just couldn't move fast enough.
Yeah.
Boom, game over. But the funny thing that happened is on that first advance, I was playing against Legolas and my 17 archers plus Lurch. They marched and drummed, but they only moved 7 inches. They turned left and deleted Legolas in one volley fire. 18 shots. Legolas is gone.
Wow.
And my opponent was like, whoa, I don't think I've ever seen that happen before. So it's there's
Legolas
just a lot
became
of
a human pitched pin cushion, an elven pin cushion.
There's just a lot of go ahead.
Well, I just, this army, it's so funny to our point of actually play it before you judge. So whenever you talk to supposed experts at this game, what does everybody tell you one of the most important heroic actions to have in your army?
Strike.
Is?
Strike.
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 Strike, and then it's usually march after that, and then people say defense. But march is so powerful. Have to have march. Gotta have march. Most
Gotta
games you're dealing with. 9 points of might, and you're going to use up a ninth of your store in a 600 point game for one march. And yet these same people blow off this scout list as horrible. And it like,
that is a great point.
It gets amazing movement plus free marches with the drum. I mean, it just, and you can get the 9-inch movement without the restriction of not having to charge.
It's better than march.
It's better than march. If this is a movement-based game, this should be one of the best lists if you can figure out how to just overcome the D4 and the fact that you can't support.
On top of that, it's a strength 4, fight 4 army.
D5, I have shields on my guys. They're not totally naked.
Okay.
Yeah. You just don't get to spear support. Yeah. If you can't find it ranks, you've got enough movement to make up for that.
No, I
that part's hard. No spear support's hard. And so you do have to be very tactical about making sure that when you engage, you can engage from front and back at the same side or at the same time. Like you do have to make sure you're swarming completely.
But the fact that they have shields really helps with that because as long as you're willing to shield, you can still get the same number of dice and you pick where you want to kill. Mm-hmm. So
While you're engulfing your enemy, they have absolutely nowhere to go. So my main success with Khand is board control. I have, you guys have known this, but I push 6 chariots at you. I block off and I pin you in one side of the board. I don't care what scenario is. That's hard to do. Hard to overcome when I have that much board control and I'm allowed free movement with all my foot soldiers or all my horsemen. Like I can see Lurtz's scouts doing that. I'm going to pin you in this spot. I'm going to make you castle up in this terrain because if you don't, I'm going to completely surround you, and that you better hope it's not a controlling or a capture control or a domination or seize the prize or any kind of objective scenario like that where I have to move, because you're not going to be able to.
Yeah, so as long as you don't mess up and get caught in a game of attrition and you don't attack the wrong castle, I can casually move. And I'm doing overkill with the drum on this. But so the list is, it's five captains, three named. So that's five strength, five heroes. So even high defense armies, as long as I can avoid, you know, getting killed by the Elendils, by the Gil-galads, etc., which isn't that hard to do with 55 models in the army. So if I drop the drum, I could even increase the model count a little bit more. I just think 14-inch move, it's people, to your point, Mitchell, until people see it on the board, they see me go from this port, I cross halfway point every single game, turn one.
Yeah. People are going to criticize this until they see you in a tournament and that scenario is reconnoiter. And they're going to go, they know they've lost, right?
Recon, seize the prize. I would say capture and control, domination, all of those. It's a huge advantage.
If they see you and seize the prize, they better hope they have a flying monster and that can pick up things turn one. And they better hope they win the roll off. If they don't get both of those things in their way, they're going to lose seize the prize.
And I would say even a flying monster only moves 12 inches.
Yep.
Well, and this is the hidden factor. And you guys were making fun of me because I'm the most anti-archer person ever. If I ever get that where somebody blows all of their resources to try and counter. So I say domination because I basically have the ability. And I've done this. Destroy the supplies. I can go. I've played like variations that are very close to Lurtz's without the addition. I played like high marauder count. I can go left to right in a turn, and I've left, if you've spread out to try and attack me on even fronts, I can completely change the entire board in one turn. And then half of you're fighting with half your army. So that's a disadvantage. But if you, even if you have like something where you're going to try and contest move, I can pull up and shoot, and I have 18 shots coming at you that are strength three. Yeah, I'm not going to, I might only get a couple kills, but then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I had to move a lot. And now I'm getting shot. I outshot elves in one of my test games.
Yeah.
It takes one good turn for the dice to go my way. And all of a sudden I get 3, 4, 5 kills. And it's like, oh, actually, I'm in trouble.
Yeah. I automatically liked Lurtz's scouts more than I liked Ugluk's, honestly. Just because I hate, personally, things that are supposed to work together. So things that are supposed to synergize. And they do not have the same move value. So basically you're going to say, okay, I'm going to take away the best advantage that the orcs get, which is their movement. I'm going to negate that so that they stick with the orcs. Or I'm going to take away the plus one and hope that they catch up in time to spear support me and run away. You know, like,
and the fact that they don't get that synergy when the orc is spear supporting, I thought was just.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even okay. I'll throw this back in your face though, because you guys haven't played Ugluk Scouts, have you?
That's true. You're a good point. Very good point.
Army on paper, but I've seen it lose twice. So you're right. So then
this is the only thing I'm going to defend myself, so I don't sound like a hypocrite, is that I said I liked Lurtz's scouts more than I liked Ugluk's scouts on paper. But you're right. I haven't play tested either or faced it.
But I've seen Ugluk scouts played a couple of times, and it does struggle. And I think it struggles because, personally, I think it struggles because you're running captains that have absolutely no answer to any hero. With Lurtz and Lurtz and Maher, I have three attack heroes that can get lucky.
Can you take Ugluk in that army too?
Ugluk is the leader. Lurtz's scouts. Yeah, that's the third captain. So I have Ugluk. Yeah, so I have two striking heroes. Lurtz, Maher, Ugluk are the named heroes. And then I take two generic captains.
And the shield throw.
Okay, that is epic. I only got to do it once. It didn't do anything in my game. But the threat had my opponents questioning it. But again, the hidden gem, guys, challenging captains. I can bully captains. I was bullying in the game against the elves. Actually, I played elves twice. In the games against elves, I was bullying the elf captains around. And it's late game. People who are thinking late game, if you lose, I'm on a soapbox, but I recognize the soapbox. If you lose late game, if you lose the ability to stand fast with an expensive captain model, it is huge. And so you're basically saying, I have to keep this captain away from Lurtz. because if Lurtz ever charges a captain, he's going to challenge. And I either have to decline and lose my benefit late game. You lose the benefit. It's a heroic actions. You can't. Captain's the most valuable thing, right? Moves and marches. It doesn't work. You lose that. Nobody will participate with you. And you can't stand fast. At that point, with my high model count, I'm absolutely going to, and I have tons of might, I'm going to be pinning. I'm going to be forcing the issue. I'm going to be trapping your heroes, whoever can still stand fast. And late game, you're going to start dropping like flies just on running away. Yep. So
absolutely.
Lurtz is challenged. That's another thing. I think people write it off until you're up against it. And all of a sudden Lurtz is commanding the battlefield because you're running away from him.
Yeah. I mean, everything changes once you see it on the table. I guarantee you. I remember Cond was last year, and I know I'm just bringing up similar things. I know I've done this a while, but Cond, I remember sending lists to you, Marcus, or to anybody, and I had my Cond list, and you're like, you could struggle against this, you could struggle at that, and it's all true. I'm not writing that wrong.
Well, it wasn't just this and that. I was going to say, I thought on paper you would struggle against more than 50% of the armies you'd face.
Right, right. It was hard. It was pretty hard criticism, and then all of a sudden it takes up the table, and I'm all the way table to table edge. I'm touching, and everything filled. And then I remember I was playing one of the Seattle guys, and he goes, that's 39 models. Like, it looks like you have 60. Okay. And it hits like you have 60. And it was just like one of those things where it's, once you see it on the table, everything changes. Cause you're no longer just trying to, you know, do one thing, or you're not just breaking it apart by paper. You know, you have to actually break it apart on the table with what you have. It's a little bit different.
We're totally soapboxing here, but this is fun. I think this is why I like the game. And I think this is why I think Jay Clare is probably one of the funniest guys like I can think about conceptually, because correct me if I'm wrong, but he's a phenomenal player, evidenced by the fact that he wins a lot of his events or is like top finisher or whatever.
Yeah.
Makes sense. He's a rules writer. He should be good at the game, but he always does it with like weird armies and armies that people don't play. And he's single-handedly rewriting the meta every time he builds a list, because remember everybody was crapping on the Rohan Legendary Legion, the Helm's Deep Legendary Legion when that came out. Yes. Nobody thought that was going to be good. And then all of a sudden he wins a tournament with it. And everybody's like, oh my gosh, it's the so best good. Thing ever. Everybody buy Helm.
36 at both.
So tactical, so much synergy. Yeah. Look at all of these. It's like, oh yeah.
Look at Lake Town. How many people laughed at Lake Town and now they're terrified of it. They're terrified. Now
Lake Town is considered, you know, super good or like a must include. So, I think this game, there are so many things that are good, with the exception of the narrative heroes that they've been releasing a lot of lately, which actually suck, and they're literally just for.
Oh, like Barlin and Butterbur and Harry the Gatekeeper. Okay, yeah.
You're never gonna take. I will go on paper and say, theoretically, I haven't played it. I haven't played against. I will never take those heroes. Period.
I think it's just because you don't have a ruffian army. If you were playing a ruffian army, you're like, finally some heroes I can do. Finally something different.
Yeah, maybe they're actually OP. Who knows? But I feel like every single army has its place to shine, and it's just people who write them off, even hobbits. Yep. You play against a hobbit army at the right level with all those traps on the right scenario, and you're going to just pull your hair out.
Yeah.
So every army has its place to shine.
Well, I think
every army can be meta if played properly.
I'm 100% on board that. And I think it's also like for all those good players out there, there are some very, very good players out there, much better than me. Why not take it as a challenge for the most part? Like, hey, I'm going to make this army good. I'm going to figure out how it works. I'm going to figure out all the ins and outs, the synergies that nobody thought about, and I'm going to show it onto the table. You know, I just love that challenge. Maybe that's just me. I think
you're talking about this. Like,
I just found it interesting that you actually tried to like say convincingly that you thought there was a better player than you, Mitchell. Everybody knows you don't think there is.
We're on camera.
Humble brag. He's like, I'm sure somewhere on planet Earth.
Somewhere
in this universe. No.
The galaxy is expansive. We don't know all the planets. There could be a better player on Neptune 3. Like,
I say this. As Matt came over to my house and beat me, not just beat me, walloped me with my own army, just absolutely demolished me with my own army.
Well, to be fair, it wasn't really demolished. 12-0, you were really in it. I mean, it was anybody's game.
Well, I think we talked about this like one of our first episodes, the idea of skill cap in armies. Mitchell, to your point, I think good players who take on these more challenging armies unlock the potential of the armies. And I think there's a difference between easy armies to play, like Isengard. Isengard's a very easy army to pick up and play because they're good at the base level. They do everything reasonably well, and you don't get punished a lot unless your hero play like is total trash. The ability for you to get punished is minimized. So armies like Angmar, you can get punished really bad with Angmar if you play that wrong. If you die too quick and start running away to people fleeing,
Heroes in combat, yeah, Angmar's not, other than your monsters, I would say, but yeah.
Yeah, so there's a lot of armies, I think, that are high skill cap. So, yeah, if you screw up, you're going to screw up royally. But if you pull it off, big things coming.
Yep, I agree with that.
So, anyways, that's my rant. That's the end of my rant.
Well, I got a rant, too. It's just been bugging me. That's all.
Yeah, I want some of these bigger tournaments to start happening again so people can see what's winning. Mm-hmm. Actually, no, I'm back on another rant. What Jay does every time they do their UK events, he always publishes, hey, these are the armies that were represented. And it's usually evenly distributed. And he always comments with the fact, I guess, the game's still healthy because the meta isn't disproportionately favoring a couple armies. Mm-hmm. And these are people playing in grand tournaments that are trying to win. Nobody's throwing. So everybody is coming with a fairly even representation of all armies in their quest to win. So it's not 40K where the top five armies dominate. Well, actually, it's like the top seven armies dominate the GTs.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, now my rant's over.
Nope.
Rant concluded.
And another thing. No, I'm just kidding.
That reminded me. No. So, with that being said, I'm really considering taking Lertz's Legendary Legion to the Canadian tournament in September. Ooh. Because I'm pretty sure that was 800 points.
It's 600. Evil.
Oh, that's the 600 one. Okay, that'll be my Angmar monster list. That's okay. That's another one I'm proving right now. Angmar monsters, no upgraded Witch King. This is my new passion.
Yeah.
I think the Witch King is 70 points base or 75 points base.
Mm-hmm. 70.
As is. Maybe one fate. I've gotten burned by not having the one fate. The lucky shot. Samwise Gamgee.
One no might. The Witch.
No might, no fate, no extra will. Witch King as is. Flanked by two cave trolls, wild warg chieftain, birder, and a horde of orcs. It's a monster mash.
Wow.
That's the reaction everybody gives. And then you get beat by it. You're like, oh, actually.
Yeah, I'm trying to see. So you're looking at three cave trolls. And another strength 6 monster in the Wild Warg Chieftain.
That moves 10 inches.
Right. I can. And then you have magic on top of that. You're talking about 4 strength 6 monsters, basically, and magic Witch King behind it. That, yeah, with Harbinger, by the way, to help your monsters out. Yeah, I at 600 points, I would find it very hard.
Is that 600? I think that might be 800 points.
Okay.
There's too many trolls. That's the 800 point version.
Okay.
But there's a scaled down version at 600 points with the same concept.
So you're still talking 30 plus models with at least 2 to 3 monsters plus a Witch King.
No, at the 800 points, I'm like 45 models.
No, I'm at 600. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In 600, I'm in the 30s.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Anywho, that might be why I try to test out and make work at the Canadian event.
I am excited because tomorrow I get to play Earl the Young for the first time since Marcus beat me in the tournament in Canada.
It's taking you that long to recover?
I know. It's been that.
Earl has been banished.
Yes.
I don't think it was 12-0, but wasn't it like 11-0 or 10-0?
I think we did conclude it was 12-0. I gave you full VPs, I think.
No, I think it was 10-0. I don't think I, okay. I didn't triple my kill count. I only doubled the kill count.
Okay.
Not that I remember anything. I think it was just, you know, those casual games.
I don't just wake up at 2 a.m. sweating. Beaten with my own army. That was the biggest insult. I was beaten with dwarves.
You were beaten with a better...
That did make it way worse. You're like,
that was the worst insult
that was,
of all.
That was the first time I played dwarves. I beat you with a better version. I beat you with a better version of your own army. I told you Kingdom of Moria was going to be better than Khazad Doom.
You beat me with my Khazad Guard. You played it for the first time. It was the final round of a 5-round tournament, and it was my brother. There was just backhand to backhand to backhand constantly.
Yes.
But I don't remember. I don't hold a grudge. It's okay.
That's good. That's good. We would have issues
if not hold grudges.
So, the Earl thing, just I keep bringing it to like the game days or stuff like that. And obviously COVID hit, that hurt bad. But I just keep bringing it, and everybody's I play against, I'm like, I'm gonna play Earl, and then I pull out my Easterlings or my Khan, and I play that. And so I think I'm finally dedicated. I'm said I gotta play it, so I'm gonna do it tomorrow.
It's hard to, because your list that was actually pretty powerful is at 1,000 points, and people are not as inclined to play 1,000 point armies too. Mm-hmm.
I think I have an 800 point one that's gonna really
Do you still keep the trebuchet, or do you drop the trebuchet?
I dropped the trebuchet. So this is basically my 1,000 point list. Almost everything's the same. I do not have the trebuchet, and I do not have the extra captain and a few extra warriors. So I'm
the
at 40
horse. Or yeah, the king. The captain. No, that was the king on horse.
No, I had a captain on horse at 1,000 points too.
Oh.
So this is at 800 points. It's 40 models. I have 19 cavalry units. 8 sons, so 8 of those are sons, Earl, 2 banners on horse, the rest are Knights of Minas Tirith with lances, or a King of Men with a lance, and then I have a Knight of the White Tower, and then the rest rangers and warriors, with a war horn and 2 banners at 800 points.
I'd be interested to see how that plays, because I your trebuchet did a lot of work for you in forcing people to move, so not
it
having
did. It did, but I also saw that it took away my game a little bit. Not to say that I didn't enjoy beating Richard in that tournament, but it did take away from it a little bit to get those lucky rolls with the trebuchet, because you're like, well, now
you
can say, if I didn't roll 3 sixes in a row with a trebuchet, what would have happened? Would I have won that game? Like, yeah. I don't know. It's kind of the trebuchet thing.
That's the age old question, though, because you're investing points to get the chance to roll the dice.
It's true. That's true. So maybe I'll play test this 800.1 and say, nope, needs to have the trebuchet, and I'll add it back in. Maybe that's what'll happen. But
right on. All right. Well, we've ranted in soapbox for a while, so why don't we wrap this up?
Yep.
Any final call outs before we leave? I think we hit all the tournaments. We definitely hit our rules questions. Would love to see comments. It's been fun to respond to the comments on our YouTube page. So let us know if you have a different take on the rules question specifically. And yes. If you have, actually, I would love to hear if you have an army that you think gets dogged on. I mean, except Easterlings, because everybody knows Easterlings suck. An army except Easterlings that gets dogged on. Let us hear. Let us know.
Yeah. Yeah, or something that you want us to try to figure out. Maybe there's some army that you want to be good but you're struggling with, and it would challenge us. I would love to try to figure out an army for you and try to say, hey, this is what I figured out with it.
I literally just read Matt's eyes. He's like, who? Does that mean I have to buy another army?
No, joke's on you. He's already got it.
Yeah. He's like, I might have to pull that one out of the second closet.
Yeah.
All right. Been a blast, guys. Let's get some games in, and then we'll be back and have some more bat reps. So,
all right. Peace, everybody.
See ya.